welcome to the Roy Harper podcast. This is episode number 16 for November 2008. A little bit late this time round. As you may recall from the last podcast, I announced that my wife and I are off for a holiday to Turkey in the latter part of October. And we got back last Friday. It was a fantastic holiday, 2 weeks of utter bliss, great weather, really good stuff to see. And as you'll have gathered, I've picked the opening music as a bit of a homage to that. It's some Turkish folk dance music. We had a terrible trip back. Got back into Stansted Airport in the early hours of Friday morning, like 3:30 or something like that. And it was 0 degrees, which was a horrible, horrible change from the balmy summer days and nights that we've been enjoying for the previous 2 weeks. And finally, I got in through the front door at 6 a.m. on Friday. I've been recovering ever since, though. I think I'm pretty much back to normal now. In this show, we will have a brief news update, then part one of a two-part interview with Bill Musial. I interviewed Bill just before we went away, actually, over the phone. He lives in the USA, and I got an awfully long interview out of him, and I was tempted to split it into three parts, but I've decided to do it in two. So this and the next podcast are going to be quite interview-heavy, but Bill has some really interesting things to say. Some of you that are old-timers on the Stormcott mailing list will know of Bill of old, and you'll know his postings, and you'll know roughly what he's about. He's got some really fun anecdotes and stuff. A to Z of Harper, this time the letter O, some listener feedback and some music. Less music in this and next episode, just due to time constraints, really, because I'm still trying to keep the podcast down to a length that people can still burn to CDs. But we'll see how that goes. So, first of all, a bit of news. Nothing really on the Roy front at the moment, but Nick Harper finished his Peru Rocks expedition last month, and lots of stuff is still available if you haven't looked already at perurocks.org, and you can look at video diaries and text diaries and stuff like that. And probably more importantly, it's still not too late to donate some money to the project. It seems that things went very well. I watched some really funny interviews and stuff with Nick pretending to be a tour guide and so on and so forth. So it's well worth a look there. And you know, serious congratulations to Nick for continuing in this project. It's a very laudable thing that you're doing. And I know it's a cause that's very close to your heart because of your mother dying of cancer. And it's a disease that will strike a lot of us at some point in our lives, and it's good to raise awareness for that and keep up what you're doing. Okay, that was enough of the quick introduction, and we're going to have a bit of music then in the interview. We're going to start off with One of Those Days in England, but don't worry, it's not the 20-minute epic. I thought it might be fun to actually try out the single version.
Just begun, and half the fun and falling is you don't care where it's to. My love, it seems so long away since when we both together lay, and yet it's only yesterday, dreaming of tomorrow.
This month, my interviewee is Mr. Bill Musial, who, those of you who were on the old-style Stormcock email list years ago, will know as Mr. Bill. And he's a great music fan, not just of the Harpers, but music all round. And I thought it'd be really good to get him on here and talk around all kinds of issues that will come to light as we go forward. But hi, Bill. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, how's it going?
Yeah, not too bad. Well, I'm a bit croaky, actually. Got a bit of a cold, which is very annoying because we're going on holiday tomorrow night, and I hate flying when I've got a cold, but never mind.
Well, you can't really tell this far away across the pond, so it's not a big deal.
Well, you're too kind. So let's find out a bit about Bill, first of all. You're on the west coast of the United States, are you not?
Yeah, I'm central coast of California, not too far from Big Sur. Kind of where Roy traveled on his big American tour of 1970, where he wrote part of Stormcock.
That sounds like a pretty nice place to live, actually.
Oh, it's a beautiful, beautiful place to live.
And at the moment, it's just coming up to 5 p.m. in the UK, so it'll be just coming up to 9 a.m. where you are.
Yeah, it's a beautiful sunny day, as it always is there.
I'm turning green already, actually. So, a bit about you, first of all. How old are you, Bill?
I am 43, just turned 43 in July.
Do you know what?
Thank you very much.
So am I.
Are you?
Yeah.
Born in 65, are you?
Yeah, that's right, in May for me, yeah.
All right.
There
summer,
you go.
Summer of love. But
a fine vintage.
What did you say?
A fine vintage, I said.
It is. It's a great year, I think.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of research into that summer of 65, and it seems like it was a really good year to be born, although I guess our folks would have been shagging around the fall of 64, which would have been, I don't know, that's actually around the time Kennedy was killed.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess maybe it was a time for solace the wounds or something like that. And so
yeah. I've always
we're
felt
born
like
out of great sorrow.
I've always felt I was born a little bit too late because I missed the chance to see, you know, certain bands at their heyday because I was a bit too young.
Yeah, I hear you there. I really wish sometimes I'd been on at least maybe 5 years earlier just to see all the great bands that we
yeah.
all love so much. But then we'd be 5 years older, and I don't know if I want to feel any older than I am now.
Good so point.
It's kind of a catch-22 situation.
So what's the sort of 60-second potted life history, if you like, other than the music, which we'll get into in a minute?
Jesus.
I haven't got a timer, don't worry.
Okay. Well, born in 65, down in Hollywood, California. First child, only child of two folks who were kind of thrown together down in that whole crazy time in America, California, when California was just kind of going crazy as it did in the 60s.
Mm.
And lived down there for a couple of years. My folks ended up separating, getting divorced in 69. My mom ended up marrying her other childhood sweetheart and moving up to San Luis Obispo, which is Central California, where I've grown up ever since, the kind of area I'm in now. And her second husband, who I grew up with as my dad for the rest of my life, and they're all O'Connors. Mm. They were kind of latter-day 70s hippies, and so I kind of grew up in a kind of a, you know, raised by wolves or rights or whatever you can call it. Just kind of very liberal, progressive parents in the 70s. A lot of freedom. It was very progressive California lifestyle. There's all those cliches of, you know, there was marijuana around and all that kind of stuff. And I definitely had a liberal childhood where I was able to roam free and, you know, just lots of liberal type. And I use the word liberal. I want to take back the word liberal. Liberal, because I'm really tired of conservatives and media, whoever, saying liberal like it's a bad word. Because I'm very happy to be a liberal. Mm. And I think liberal, progressive ideas and ideals are something that the world needs. And I get sick when I hear the word liberal bandied about it, like it's a bad thing. So, anyways, raised very liberal. I'm getting way too drawn out here, but basically grew up in California in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and went to high school, went to college, dropped out of high school early, joined the Air Force for 3 months, didn't really like that, got out early, kind of have that thing akin to Roy. I think he was in the military for a little while and got out early, right? He did do that, right?
Yeah. What did you do in the Air Force?
I just went through basic training, and by the time I got done with that, I realized it was this huge psychology experiment. I hated it, and I said, I want out. And they had promised me to send me to Europe. That was my whole reason for joining, was I wanted to go to Europe. I always had these childhood fantasies of Europe and castles and dragons and all that crap. And I really wanted to go there, and that was my ticket to Europe, because I couldn't afford it otherwise. And so they promised me, you know, like stationing in Germany. Well, when I finished basic training, they said, no, you're going to go to North Dakota. And
not quite the same thing.
Yeah. I've seen these pictures of, you know, 20-foot snowdrifts, you know, guarding a missile silo in North Dakota, and that's not where I'm going to go. So
yeah.
When they said North Dakota, I said, no, thank you. And I said I wanted out. And so they sent me off to the Air Force loony bin there in Lackland, Texas, which is this crazy, crazy place. And I was 17 at the time, very young, youngest guy there. And at that time, you could drink in the military in Texas, so I was basically getting drunk every night, trying to get out of there. They would do a battery of tests and all this stuff, and they basically just said, he's not crazy, just wants out.
Yeah.
Which, to them, is crazy, but to me, is pretty sane.
Yeah.
And I got out. So I was there from, like, October to December of 82, and got out right before Christmas, and came back to California, and it was just like this three-month-old trip to Texas, very bizarre educational experience. I kind of share that with Roy, which I've always appreciated. We got to taste the military, but get out before it was...
Well, it's just another life experience. I mean, whether you liked it or not, it's helped shape the person you are now.
Yeah, it does, it does.
Yeah.
And then did some various things, you know, from between the age of 17 and 20 or so, did a lot of school and exploring and, you know, the usual partying and drug intake and all that. And then I went off and left California because I was just getting too crazy. And I went over to Hawaii. And I went to Hawaii to just kind of get away from the craziness of California, and went and ended up being a live-in babysitter for a couple there for a couple of months. And then ended up living on a beach there for a month in January of 85, and did that for a little while.
That doesn't sound so bad. No, that sounds good.
It was a lot of fun, but I kind of discovered there that you could just, you know, living on a beach, similar to, like, I think Roy lived a couple of days on a beach.
Yeah.
You can kind of live that idyllic lifestyle, you know, if you don't get in trouble with the law or whatever for a long time, but it's like you just kind of get sucked into this other world that kind of seduces you, but it's really hard to, you just feel like the whole rest of the world is passing you by and you feel like you have to go back to it.
Oh, it's like taking a bit of a time out from it all, isn't it, I suppose?
Say again?
It's like taking a time out from it all.
Yeah, it was a nice rest, a respite, but I felt like I had to go back and move on. And I was running out of money, too. So,
yeah.
Although you can live pretty easily off the land there. So came back, went back to school full-time, did that. Eventually met my future wife, and we had some kids, and then dropped out of school, went to work full-time, blah, 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 blah. And then somewhere along there I met ran into Roy and his music. Actually, right when I got back from Hawaii, I ran into Roy and his music, and so that's kind of the next part of the story.
Yeah.
So that's my first 20-odd years. Not well, in 60 seconds, mind you.
No, no. Well, let's talk about music, since that's, you know, why we're here, I guess. I find that people have different perspectives on music, and a lot of the people I know through the Harper connection, of course, are very, very into their music. And they'll be able to say, you know, what their first few albums that they bought were, and why they suddenly realised how important music was going to be to them. Other people just don't have that at all. They treat music as another sort of stimulus that comes in through their ears, but doesn't really engage them. So, I mean, what was how did the music appreciation start? What were the first few albums, and when did you find? What was it that made you think, yeah, this is really something that's important to me?
Yeah, I'm definitely one of those people that music is like all consuming their life, almost to a my wife would say a one dimensional unhealthy degree.
Yeah,
look around the house. There's too many records and CDs, and she doesn't like it.
Right,
spend too much money, that kind of thing. And to some extent, she's right. But you know, and she's one of those people that's like it's just one facet of her life.
Oh yeah, yeah,
gardening is her passion. So we all have different passions.
We do,
but I distinctly remember the first albums I bought. I was the oldest kid in my family, and so I didn't have older brothers and sisters, which I think for many people that's a great entry into music when you have older brothers and sisters that bring home records, and that would have been a great way. But because I didn't, I just remember for some reason back in 1980 when I was 15, going down to the local record store, Boo Records, where I still shop and I've worked at, and I for some reason had found out about The Who, and I went and bought... My first two records were Who Live at Leeds
and brilliant.
Meaty Beady Big Mountie, the kind of best of that Pete had compiled.
Yeah.
And I bought those two records for $5 each, took them home, and I've literally been hooked on The Who and rock and roll ever since. And I love those albums. Who is still my first love. Pete Townsend has been one of my big spiritual, musical, lyrical gurus ever since. I mean, I just love his stuff. And that was kind of where my musical journey began. And from there, it went from The Who to kind of discovering Led Zeppelin, and they're kind of very kindred-type bands and spirits. And then Jimi Hendrix came along.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of Tall and Traffic. And then, all that whole kind of British classic rock of the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
Up until about 1986 was when I discovered Roy.
Well, and how did that come about? What was the circumstances, and how did it hit you?
Well, I'm not sure exactly, but I know I read an interview. I was into Zeppelin very heavily in around 85, and I read an interview in some magazine with Jimmy Page, and he talked about how his favorite acoustic guitar work and solo was on this Roy Harper track, Sable Rock.
Oh, right, yeah.
He really liked his solo on that song. And I read that interview somewhere, I think, in 85, and I don't know if it was... In those 3 months that I was on Kauai, in the North Shore of Hawaii, or if it was right when I got back, and I was in L.A. staying at my uncle's house. But right when I got back from Hawaii, I went to a record store down in L.A., and I was looking around, and I just read this article, and I wanted to check out this guy, Roy Harper, and I was going through the racks, and I'd never seen him or seen his records or anything. And I'm going through the racks, and I see two Roy Harper albums, and Stormcock and Valentine.
Oh, good.
Bottom.
Yeah.
And it was you couldn't pick a better place to start than those two. I mean, they're really still two of my very favorite, if not my two favorite Roy Harper albums.
Yeah.
They were, U.S. Chrysalis issues. Actually, I still have the one right here in front of me, and I think it ended up being it was a New Zealand pressing of Stormcock, which is just an amazing-sounding pressing. And, I've since had it signed by Roy, and it's one of my pride and joys.
Oh, that is.
It's an amazing album. And that was kind of where I started with those two. And a couple other early ones I got, as soon as I got those, I was, of course, hooked. And I got HQ, which here was When an Old Cricket Leaves a Crease.
Yeah.
And there was a local record store, Boo Boo's, had a copy of that. And they had flashes from the archives of Oblivion. And strangely enough, they had a second pressing, that kind of, not the really rare one, but the second reissue on Awareness of Born in Captivity.
Mm.
And I think one other one, the best of 70, 75, and that was kind of where I started with Roy in 86.
Right.
Yeah.
So you took to it almost from the beginning then. You understood what he was getting at and liked it immediately? Because a lot of people, it takes a long time. It sort of creeps up on them.
Well, I think when you start with Stormcock, you kind of get hooked right away. I mean, I basically started with the cream of the crop. And yeah, I'd say I loved him right away. I mean, I was hooked with those early albums. And I don't think that I was instantly like the hardcore fan.
Yeah.
Because when I reflect back on it now, when I ended up going to England and meeting him in 92. I mean, there's about 5-6 years between 86 and 92 there.
Right.
And during that time, I had collected almost all of his albums, if not all his albums, and a lot of the hors d'oeuvres magazines and all that.
Yeah.
I obviously had become a big fan, but I don't think that, like, I immediately started collecting them all. I think around 86, when I got together with my wife, I started becoming a serious record collector. And during that next couple of years, I collected a lot of his records. But I wouldn't say, like, you know, if I got the hors d'oeuvres magazines somewhere, well, actually, I got those in England, too. So I'd say somewhere around maybe 89, 90, I started to become real serious about him. Like, obviously, he must have touched a chord in me early on if I started with those albums and then started getting his stuff as I went along. And, yeah, I'd say he definitely was a, you know, became a huge, I definitely identified with him in his music right away, because I think with my very, you know, progressive liberal upbringing and my kind of, I've always had this kind of a outsider view of the world,
yeah,
and
yeah,
kind of a, you know, this is that whole wolf sheep thing. And
yeah.
My kids can be crap about this all the time. They're like, you're wolf and you're sheep and all this crap, you know. Because we basically do this mostly about traffic, you know. We're out in traffic. We're all those sheep in that long line. Let's be a wolf and take this short line, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And basically they're saying I'm driving like a dick and they're, you know, they're being good. But I basically have identified with, you know, that kind of aspect of his personality that says, whoa, you know, there's some really fucked up things going on in the world here. We need to question authority. We need to question what's
exactly
going on here.
Yeah.
Our leaders are, you know, way out there.
That's right.
So that kind of aspect of his personality and his, you know, kind of reasoning has always appealed to me. And I think that I definitely identified with that in his music and his lyrics. You know, to me, it's like he and Dylan were like the people going, you know, we need to stop here and take a look around.
Mm. You know? No, that's really accurately and well put, I think. I think that's what most of us tune into. And it's the fact that somebody's actually going to stand up there and say, look, don't be sheep, you know. There are other ways of thinking about things. You don't have to do the easy thing. You can do the right thing. You know, and it's an important thing. And that's where music becomes... that's where music becomes serious in a way. And I think... I know you haven't had time to listen to the Roy interview properly yet, but we talked a bit about music, and we talked a bit about when it actually becomes, or when it became a force for delivering a message, not just, you know, the standard boy-girl three-minute pop single. Suddenly it became something else, and there's a big change, and a lot of us really tuned into that. Would you say that the sort of early mid-70s is your favourite period of Roy's stuff then?
The early mid 70s. Yeah, definitely. You know, I think I recently did my master's thesis on rock and roll, and you know, I said that 1971 was kind of like the peak period of rock, and of course,
if you look at the number of albums that came out by all these bands, it's just staggering, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's this whole kind of a crest of the wave around 69, 70, 71, even going into 72, and you could argue that 70 was the best year, or 71, you know, that kind of 69 even. But if you look at 71, there's kind of this apex where you have like Stormcock and Led Zeppelin 4 and Joni Mitchell's Blue and Honky Dory by Bowie and Aqualung and Sticky Fingers and blah, 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 blah. And it's really there's this apex that gets reached where kind of the music collides and the counterculture starts to explode, and there's this, a lot going on, too complicated to get into now, but there was definitely a peak that got reached then. And I think what you were asking in your question is when, you know, when rock and roll got serious was, you know, it's definitely, I think, Dylan started it. And
yeah, a lot of people say that.
With his folk protest lyrics of 63, 64, you know, it's like all of a sudden the boy and girl stuff goes out the window, and he's like, okay, music can have a conscience, and it can have a message, and it can say stuff. And, you know, all the folk protest stuff that had already been going on in England in the 50s, but was, you know, definitely underground and just small time, kind of starts to come to fruition in the late 50s with the folk rock boom, and it's kind of, Dylan has given that thing kind of a kick, and there's a folk rock boom in America too, but when Dylan goes electric, and then all the other, you know, the Beatles come on board with that kind of music can be a message, and everybody else comes on board with rock lyrics that all of a sudden saying, you know, we have a voice. It's a very potent combination, because there was this whole baby boom generation, both in England and America, there was a whole huge bubble of young people that all of a sudden had Dylan and then a bunch of Dylan followers. Is it alkaloid? Is that the word? How do you say the word? You know, like followers or like junior priests or whatever.
Acolytes, yeah.
Acolytes, yeah.
Yeah.
All those little junior followers of Dylan's that were like, you know, musicians, who, and especially the Beatles, who were huge into him, Lennon and all that, they're all, you know, following him, and all of a sudden they're all singing about relevant issues and about what they see going on around in society, and you have this all of a sudden almost common voice saying, we have a common consciousness, and this is what's going on in the world, this is what we see, this is what we don't like, this is, you know, what we think about it. And so all of a sudden rock music becomes this kind of almost a common consciousness. Mm. And that's what kind of happened in the late 60s, I see. And maybe I'm reading more into it because I wasn't really there, but it seems to me that there was definitely a kind of common consciousness being created, and it had a lot of potential for change. And I think that it could have actually affected some real good change if it hadn't have been kind of co-opted and commercialized like it was. Big business saw that there was money to be made, and they kind of rushed in there like they always do, and they took it over, and they made money out of it. And, you know, once you co-opt that thing and throw the money key in there, you know, you kind of corrupt the whole
thing.
You do.
Corrupt is the right word.
Yeah. And I think that of all the people, and I threw this into my master's thesis, and unfortunately my advisor made me make it a footnote because he said, Roy Harper who? You know, I don't know who this guy is.
Sacrilege.
Yeah, he made me put it as a footnote, is that because I really think that Harper is, of all the people, and especially in England, he was the logical successor to what Dylan was doing in 65 with that whole kind of surrealistic poetry. Because Dylan realized around 65 that you couldn't keep doing what he was doing, saying it blatantly, without kind of getting popped, getting killed, like, you know, Malcolm X and Kennedy and those people were getting popped left and right. I mean, it was literally dangerous. You were going to die. And so you had to kind of get surrealist and almost, you know, hide in the drugs and the Rambo poetry and that kind of stuff and be a rebel, but almost hide it in clues that only the hip could understand.
Only the intelligent people.
Yeah, exactly.
If you like,
and so,
rather than stupid.
So it's almost like Desolation Row was still radical, subversive poetry, but it was poetry that only, you know, Mr. Jones wasn't understanding, but the hip would understand what was going on. And I think Harper was the natural extension of that, and starting with songs like Sophisticated Beggar and going on to songs on Genghis Smith and you know, Magoon's Blues especially. I think Magoon's Blues is like Harper's Declaration of Independence of, here I am, I'm the British version of Dylan, not that that's a bad thing, you know, I mean, Harper's his own man, but he's saying, you know, look, over here in England, we've got the same
this is where it is.
Going
yeah.
on. And I think that Harper, you know, continues that tradition as the troubadour, the British person who's saying, you know, look at this. This is a fucked up world we live in. And look at these things. Look at the religion and what's going on. Look at the society and what's going on. You know, we have to fix these things. And I think that Harper, you know, circa 69, 70, 71, was the man in England that was railing against society the most ferociously, most honestly and truthfully. And he made the best music then, and of course, you know, nobody heard it.
Well, that's the thing. Is that famous quote from Robert Plant? He says that one of these days Harper will become famous and he'll be recognised for everything that he's done, and nobody's listening to what he's got to say. You know, I'm paraphrasing. I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was in a magazine interview once, and I think that's absolutely right. And I think. Well, I don't want to get too much into conspiracy theories, but I think there are a lot of people that have blocked his message deliberately because they don't like what he's saying, you know, and the establishment will do that.
Yeah. You know, as far as what I was saying with Dylan, you know, purposely went kind of underground after a certain point and had his accident and then went all kind of country and did his whole weird thing that he did. And Harper never really ever compromised. He didn't get famous enough to where he needed to worry about getting shot or anything because he never really had the voice that drew the crowd. You know, and people like Lennon had to go underground at a certain point. So Harper never really had that fear of that kind of thing. And so he was always able to speak truth. And I think that that, you know, is a double-edged sword. He was always able to speak truth, but because he was speaking truth to such a small portion of the people, you know, it was like, you know, he was speaking, I don't know, it's like a catch-22. He wasn't able to affect that much change because not that many people heard.
He said before that he feels sometimes like he's preaching to the converted, to use a religious metaphor, you know.
You know, and lots of people wonder, whether it's all his famous musician friends or whoever, you know, why it didn't happen for him, you know, and whether it's, you know, Stormcock coming out when there's no budget left, or, you know, whether Flat Broken Berserk just was too much of a weird party record, or whatever the different labels that his first couple albums came out on.
Yeah.
I don't think it was because the music wasn't quality. I just, you know, maybe it wasn't the hit single, you know, and maybe it was the, you know, the shambolic American tour of 1970. You know, I mean, he definitely never was willing to play the game as far as compromises as having a hit or doing a tour that would promote, or, you know, he was never willing to play the commercial game, and that's no slag on him. And so that kind of affected that whole thing, but in a way it kept his music and his art pure, which is good for those at least who needed to appreciate him and his message. So, I mean, there is a, I mean, when you look at later on when he did kind of try to go commercial a little bit, there was a drop in quality. So, I mean, it has its ups and downs.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he never made very many friends in the music industry, and that certainly didn't help.
Yeah.
You know. It's a shame that in those days you didn't have the same kind of home recording cottage industry type facilities that you can get away with now. You know, you can make stuff in your own house and stick it out on your own. And if he'd done that, well, I don't know. Who knows what would have happened?
Well, when you think about it, I mean, being signed to EMI, I now I remember what I was going to say. Is, you know, I mean, being signed to EMI Harvest at that time, which was one of the hip happening labels. You know,
yeah.
Pink Floyd was on there, and I mean, recording at Abbey Road, where the Beatles were recording, and Floyd and McCartney and all that. I mean, he had the best with what he was doing with Stormcock and with Life Mask and Valentine and all that, and even HQ.
Yeah.
He had the best recording equipment. He had, you know, the Floyd recording there, all those different people, recording engineers, the best sounding records that he could make. He was making his best albums. So for that stuff not to hit was not necessarily, I don't think, a conspiracy, is that it was just, I mean, those albums, when you think about it, Stormcock, Life Mask, and HQ, I mean, that stuff's pure, unadulterated Roy at his finest.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I love it, and I don't think I could change any of it. And if the general public doesn't like it or can't appreciate it, I don't know what to say to that. I think that time will show it's beautiful, amazing music. But obviously, you know, the Lord's Prayer is not something that's going to be radio-friendly or be appreciated, you know. Maybe I would like the front poem to be a great single, I think, you know.
Yeah.
With this massive erection of pushy defense, you know, that kind of thing. But I do think that there is an underlying current of influence that's not really appreciated in the fact that recording all that stuff there, you know, I think that his influence on people like Ian Anderson and Tull and Roger Waters, you know, all those guys nicked his acoustic strumming or his lyric lines. And, you know, there's stuff in Animals, in Dogs, and, you know, in Tull, War Child lyrics, all those guys, even into the Beatles and stuff, they all nicked a lot of his stuff and used it. So, I mean, there is kind of not necessarily a nick, but a sub, there is a influence, even into some of the Zeppelin lyrics, too, that kind of trickled out, you know. So I think that some of those other artists that did make it big took a little of that radicalness from Roy and kind of applied it to their own stuff. So, I mean, you could kind of say that there's that influence.
That's a good point.
No solace for Roy. The only thing I do wish that had happened was that there had been some kind of at least one hit single or one song on a soundtrack somewhere along the way to where he had that little royalty check coming in to where his retirement was real nice and comfortable.
That's right.
Because that's just had that one little hit that was like a big hit.
They can live on it for years.
That royalty check every year that's just enough to make them have enough comfortable retirement. They don't have to worry about, you know, the yearly tour or anything like that.
Yeah. Ian Anderson's actually always been fairly upfront, from what I've seen of him, saying that he learned a lot from Roy.
Definitely.
You know, it's
more so than Waters.
Well, there you go. The thing about him being such a pioneer and a musician's musician, I've talked about a bit before, and I really hope that at some point he'll make it. But to be a bit morbid for a moment,
you hope he'll make it,
Roy. But
it's getting a little late.
Well, the point I'm making is I'm talking really morbidly now, but I fear or think that when the day comes and he shuffles off this mortal coil, I think people are going to suddenly realise what a treasure they had, and that it's too late.
Right.
It's not a very nice thing to dwell on, but you know.
Well, you know, I Roy himself has said that, you know, and I don't know if Roy said this or somebody, but it's kind of been mentioned before that Stormcock will be recognized in future generations as this masterpiece of the 20th century, and I agree with that. And I think Roy will be realized as this great poet. And I don't think, you know, obviously that's not very good solace in your lifetime. But there were a lot of, you know, people, I think it's like, was it Picasso who was, you know, died a poor unknown artist at that time, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of genius people who were not known as famous or wealthy in their lifetimes and were not discovered till later on. And that's hardly, you know, good to hear while you're alive, but doesn't mean you're not a great, amazing person. And, you know, as a person, I'm sure somebody like Roy has to be secure in knowing that he's created great art.
Yes.
Lived his life passionately. You know, the passion's a great fortune. He's had a pretty good life. I mean, he's lived it fully. He's lived it on his terms. You know, he hasn't exactly, you know, lived in poverty. And he's had some great loves of his life. And he's had some great kids, you know, and I think with people like Nick carrying on his legacy, I mean, Nick has really blown me away because, you know, obviously he's a great kid growing up, and I love all his, you know, little kid stuff that he did along the way.
Yeah.
You just see all the album covers, but I remember when Light at the End of the Kennel came out, thinking, this is a great little EP, and it really kind of hooked me at the time, and then I lost him for a while, and then he's come back, and, you know, I kind of refound him through your website, you know, 5-6 years ago, and rejoined the fray, and especially when that Double Life album.
Oh, that is just,
this guy's amazing.
That is my favorite out of the whole lot, and it blows your head off. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then our good buddy Nick Lane got me caught up on the rest of his stuff, and when Treasure Island came out, I think Treasure Island is amazing.
Yeah, it's quite underrated.
It is.
Nick himself, I interviewed Nick actually quite a few months ago now, and he said he thought that album was too, what did he say? Not too eclectic, but just too sort of up its own arse, I think, is what he would have said if he'd have thought of it. But
I don't think so at all.
Self-indulgent, that's the word I'm looking for.
And you know what I think is one of his most amazing pieces that I think is totally off the radar and underrated is that spoken word piece on there. What's that called?
Oh, Wiltshire Towel, isn't it? Something like that.
Yeah, Wiltshire whatever. And to me, that's like his The Lord's Prayer front poem, his spoken word piece. I mean, listening to that, you know, obviously he was doing Roy's thing with the whole studio thing where you can really get into all the vocal effects, but the wordplay in that is just fucking brilliant. I mean, the guy is amazing.
Well, I'll tell you
let me finish. To me, that is like the prodigal son returns. I mean, this guy is just his, you know, there's Roy continuing on. I mean, to me, there's the legacy continuing. Because Roy is obviously an amazing vocal, legacy and talent that England has created.
Mm.
And here, the legacy has been continuing on in his son, who's obviously heavily influenced by having such a radical father. And you can see it in the blood and in the vocals that this legacy has been continued on, even to more extreme. And the lyrics in that are just amazing. And it's totally this, like, you know, again, nobody's heard the album or the song or even realizes that this is bloody brilliant. You know?
Yeah. What I was going to say was, Vicky and I went to a festival earlier in the year, Trowbridge Festival, which was in Wiltshire. And
What festival?
We went to a festival called the Trowbridge Festival.
Uh-huh.
And Nick was playing there, and he recited that poem. He played that poem, and I thought it was a really risky thing to do because, you know, it's a hard thing for an audience to listen to because most of them didn't know him. But he got almost an ovation at the end of it. Everybody, it just really clicked with everybody. And it was just something amazing to see, you know.
That would have been great to see it live.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's great to know that Roy's legacy will be continued on in his son, you know, that kind of thing. You know, because it's great. He's an amazing voice, Roy is, and to know that he's able to continue on that legacy. I know that he's got to be happy to know that his son is going on that kind of railing against society thing, you know.
Yeah. So let's talk briefly. I mean, for everybody that listens to these podcasts will know, I normally have a sort of vague outline of stuff I want to cover. We've talked a bit about Roy and his music and lyrics and so on. I particularly wanted to ask you about Roy in particular, but music in general as well, in terms of innovation. Because a lot of musicians will tell you that there's no new song, there's no new music. It's all kind of a reinterpretation of stuff that's gone before. Do you think Roy has been really good at pulling together all kinds of stuff and reinterpreting it, or do you think he's actually done something truly original?
Let me think about this here. true and original. Well, that's hard. I mean, he was in there in the vanguard of the late 60s, you know, that kind of whole folk rock boom.
Yeah.
So, I mean, nowadays I would say it's almost impossible to do anything original. When I think back to his early albums, you know, the first couple were kind of that whole folk rock boom, but then, you know, the psychedelics were starting to come in there. I'd say definitely his early spoken word pieces, I think of like the bits of spoken word bit that were on Come Out Fighting Genghis Smith.
Oh, and Circle,
Circle, and I think at the end of the... Is it the end of the title track has that spoken word bit?
Yes, it does, yeah.
Where he's falling in the muddy hole or whatever.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff, I mean, was pretty radical for a record in, you know, 67, 68. So I think that's kind of spreading it. And then I think, you know, a song like I Hate the White Man, you know, for 19... And even McGowan's Blues for 69. I mean, Dylan had left us off with Desolation Row in 65, and really nobody had picked up that torch, that flame of surrealistic folk protest poetry since then, to that extent that Roy kind of picked up that torch, I feel, with McGowan's Blues, and kind of took it to the next level with McGowan's Blues. I think that was taking that kind of thing to the next level. So, I mean, but you had said, you know, breaking new boundaries. I think that he took that to the next level with that. You know, again, it's kind of like that one take thing, but you're kind of taking on society and you're going at it in length for, you know, 16, 17 minutes, the whole band coming in there too at the end, having the spoken word bit, and just balls to the wall with the vocal performance and all that. And then I think get a little bit later on, and some of the stuff that he did on Stormcock with utilizing Abbey Road and the layers of vocal effect. You know, he was definitely utilizing the new studio tracks that they had in Abbey Road and all the latest stuff that the Floyd and the Beatles were using that was just kind of cutting edge vocal studio effects and all the stuff that was going on at Abbey Road circa 1970 with that. And then 73 with Life Mask, I mean, the Lord's Prayer was pretty cutting edge, I'd say. You know, about the same time Dark Side of the Moon was being created there, he was doing the Lord's Prayer, and that is, you know, quite a piece.
Yeah.
So I'd say that's definitely cutting edge. And it's also cutting edge as far as, you know, putting, not necessarily a sidelong piece, because there have been other sidelong pieces, but putting together a thing that is so many epic parts to it, a last will and testament, trying to cover 3,000 years of human history, you know,
yeah,
in a song, you know. I mean, that's pretty epic statement to be making circa 73 in rock music. I mean, to try to kind of cover all of mankind's history and have a social commentary on society at the same time, and all that he did there, pretty amazing. I'm trying to think later on. Nothing really jumps up to my mind at the moment.
Well, I was going to ask you, actually, Bill. I mean, we've been talking a lot about the earlier stuff. Uh-huh. How do you get on with the later albums? You know, like the Unknown Soldier, Blinaming Vase, Jugular, Green Man.
The later albums, I think is peak period, somewhere around Blinaming Vase. And I find this true with almost all artists, is that there's a peak early period, and then something happens, whether it's commercial fame or burnout or something,
yeah,
to where they go into a secondary phase. It's not as good. Sometimes they have a comeback phase. It's not necessarily, you know, great, more commercial success, but they just kind of find their music in, and they get into a second phase, and I think Roy has one of those too.
Uh-huh.
Or something happens along the way to where they regain their feng shui, or whatever you want to call it. But I definitely think Roy hit a bad patch around, you know, the Black Sheep period, and there are some great tracks on Unknown Soldier, but, you know, parts of it are getting pretty middle of the road to me. And Work of Heart is not my favorite.
It hasn't aged well at all.
I think the demos on Born in Captivity, I really like a lot of those.
Uh-huh.
That was one of my early favorite albums. I know Jugular is very popular in England. I like
it
about
is.
Half of it. Bad Speech is one of my favorite Roy songs. I just love that as a spoken word piece, poem.
Yeah.
But, you know, generally that period from about 78 to 88 or so is really, to me, a weak period for Roy.
Yeah.
I really think he picked it back up around Descendants of Smith Once period, and probably one of my top five Roy albums of all time is Death or Glory. And
a lot
of people, I don't think, appreciate Death or Glory. I mean, I have a personal attachment to that album because I heard half of it in his home studio. He played it for me, like, the night he finished it.
So yeah, I'd like to talk to you about that in a minute.
A little bit of personal bias to that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that album, I think, is a brilliant album aside from that. I mean, I think it's his blood on the tracks, to use a cliche. I think it's an amazingly personal statement. I think it's honest and raw, and I think it's one of the best things he's ever done. I also think Green Man is an amazing album. I love the Green Man. So I think he's had a really renaissance in the last, you know, between 92 and 2000.
Mm.
So I've been really happy with what's happened in the 90s. So I'm really bummed that it's been so long since the Green Man. I'd love to have had a sequel to that.
Yeah. I don't know. Did you ever pick up a copy of the DVD that he brought out? Beyond the Door.
Yeah. I got that. That was really enjoyable.
Yeah, that was good. I mean, he put a lot of his artistic efforts into that, but I think a lot of people are just eager for more new songs, you know.
Well, this has been the longest patch. I mean, I'm one of these people that, like, looks at periods and sees how long there's been between albums, and, you know, he had a long patch after Death or Glory, and that's understandable because he went through a lot of changes after that album until Dream Society, which was like about 5-6 years later, and there was a lot of good archival stuff that came out in between with the BBC sessions and you know, Born in Captivity
and Les Cousins,
and so that, you know, it was fairly painless. But then this gap since 2000 with the Green Man is now going on 8 years, and I know he wanted to put the book out of a DVD and toured a lot, and he was going through a lot of changes too. But this is now going on 8 years; is by far the longest gap. And I know he's getting on there and everything. He's got a lot on his mind. And, you know, the world, we've all kind of gone into this really deep, dark hibernation because of fucking Bush years here in America. and I don't know what it's been like over there, but I'm sure it's not been much
better
now that we're in the current state.
Not great.
But that's getting into something we don't want to get into yet. But I do think that there's, like, a key Roy period, the first phase from, like, about, you know, 67 to 77. A kind of a down period for about 10 years, and then there's like a resurgent second phase.
Mm. Tell us a bit then about the circumstances that led to you hearing some of Death or Glory from the source.
Ah, the famous pilgrimage to Roy. First of all, I got to preface this with a disclaimer saying, don't try this at home, kiddies. Obviously, the man needs his privacy, we're not all supposed to hang out at Tom Tiddler's ground, so to speak. But what happened was, I didn't intend to go there and meet him. I went in 92 to kind of fulfill my childhood dream of going to England and seeing the castles and the dragons and that kind of thing. And I went there with a couple of $1,000 and just kind of a vague notion that I was going to go to England and Germany and France or whatever. No set itinerary.
Mm.
The only thing I had on my plan was I had some tickets to the Jethro Tull Convention. at Milton Keynes.
Oh, right.
Great bastion of English culture, Milton Keynes.
Yeah, right.
So I had tickets for that, and I had a friend in London who had a flat that I could stay at. He's actually a squatter in a flat.
Yeah.
So I got there in the early July of 92, and I had brought some albums to trade in London to get some money for to buy other albums. And I had brought like 5 albums with me in hopes of getting them autographed in my little illusion that I had a couple Jethro Tull albums like Aqualung, had a couple Roy Harper albums, I had my original Stormcock, which I have with me right now. And I had actually just recently picked up a copy of that Intro to Roy Harper album.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, that rare American promotional album?
Yeah.
Which I had oddly found right before I came on the trip in a in the Beatles section of a record store.
Oh, right.
In the Beatles section because
of McCartney, Harper. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how much Roy influence is there in America. It's in the Beatles section of a record store. And I also had a couple Zeppelin albums, so I thought, you know, I'll go find Jimmy Page. And
from, you know. Yeah, work out where his castle is, yeah.
This is my naivete. I'll find his castle, and it's on my record. So I got there, and oddly enough, first thing, my buddy Adam in London, and he had a little flat that he squatted in Clifton Gardens. One of his fellow people at his clinic, actually, where they were, like, recovering methadone addicts or whatever. It was a real great story. Was actually one of Roy's ex-girlfriend, Sunshine from Copenhagen from like 1965's ex-husband.
Right. Yeah.
So he, like, you know, had this various vicarious, you know, 3 times removed, 6 degrees of separation knowledge of Roy from his ex-wife. So, you know, somehow I got this Sunshine from Copenhagen's phone number or something like that. And that's all I had was a phone number. Then I, you know, did my time in London and went to a rave, and that was great. That was a really exciting time, the only time I ever did something like that. Spent way too much of my money in London and had a good time, and then I thought I'd either get out of there, and I went off to Wales, and I went to this, was going to go to the Happy Days Free Festival, and I went there, and that was way too anarchic and crazy. So I went off to the Cricket Gaming Fair, and I spent my 27th birthday there, which was really neat. This really cool hippie festival in Wales. And I kind of did my last day of total wild partying there, had a great time, and then on my 27th birthday in July of 92, I stopped partying totally. No more drugs, no more alcohol, nothing. And I quit there, and then I came back to London, and my buddy was still partying radically. So I forgot, while I was in Wales, I managed to find the daughter of this guy I had met in London, who knew Roy through Sunshine in Copenhagen. I met her. And it was actually through the daughter that I got her mother's phone number and called her.
Uh-huh.
And all she told me was that, oh, yeah, I think Roy lives somewhere over in Ireland in a, you know, in a nun's house or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's all she said. And I didn't think nothing of it, and then I went back to London. Well, my buddy in London is still partying crazy. I've given up partying, and I've spent too much money there, and I was like, I got to get out of London. So I went to France, and I went to the south of France and spent a couple weeks with some friends who... I stayed with there and listened like Pink Floyd Obscured by Clouds and had a good time.
Oh, yeah.
Came back to London. It's now late August. I'm out of money. I'm really missing my family back home. I need to go back home.
Yeah.
I realize that the party's over. It's time to go. And I've got like enough money for like a week left to go do something. I'm trying to decide, should I go to Scotland for a week or should I go to Ireland for a week? And I decided I'm going to go to Ireland for a week. Maybe I can find Roy.
Mm-hmm.
It's really kind of like just kind of going whichever way the wind blows, really not really focused on any set plan, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just kind of, I really like to see Ireland, I'm going to go to Ireland for a week. So I got a ticket to Dublin on the bus from London, and when I got to Dublin, I had like a week for Ireland and a week to get back to Dublin for the bus back to London, and then I had to fly home. So this is mid-August, and I got there. When I got in Dublin, I had $40 left for the week. So I hitchhiked from Dublin to Galway, spent the night there, and in Galway I met, actually this was the first time I'd ever seen somebody busking, playing a Roy Harper song.
Oh, right, busking, yeah.
Yeah, there was a guy busking there playing, I'm going to play you Judas Iscariot. He played Don't You Grieve, and that was kind of cool. And then I met this, some Scandinavian German type guy who was, doing a documentary on the gypsies of Ireland. And I stayed at his tent for the night because there were some really kind of scary people in Galway down by the railroad tracks type thing. So I was really happy to meet a friendly face who let me stay at his tent for the night by the church and, you know, safety and all that. And then I was going to head down south because I knew that it was somewhere in County Cork that was where I was headed towards for Roy's. And I met this couple that had pitched me up hitchhiking, and we were heading down the Cliffs of Moher, you know that area?
No, I don't actually.
County Clare, the Cliffs of Moher, heads down towards Dingle Peninsula and Bantry and all that area. And they picked me up, and they ended up keeping me along with them for a day or two, all down this whole beautiful coast, Ring of Kerry, all that real touristy west coast of Ireland stuff. And they dropped me off in a place called Bantry.
Yes, I've been there. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, Bantry. They dropped me off in Bantry, and when I'm there, I have no place to stay. I'm basically out of money. I'm eating peanut butter and crackers. No idea what I'm going to do. And these two girls walk by, and I have a sign saying, "Help, I need a place to stay for the night." I made a sign.
Yeah.
And they come back by a few minutes later, and they said, "We're playing a gig of our Irish music around the corner. If you want to come around and take the money at the door for the night, you can stay at our hostel for the night."
Oh, that's really nice.
Yeah, I thought it was great.
Yeah.
And I said, sure. And so I end up, you know, stone broke, taking all this money from German tourists for the night.
Yeah.
To this Irish band that's playing music.
Yeah.
And I did that. And then at the night, end of the night, they let me, you know, stay overnight at the little hostel with all, on the floor with all these German hostel people.
Yeah.
Well, it turned out one of those two women, I think her name was Mary, knew Noel Redding.
Ah, right.
Yeah, and
okay.
She used to play music with him.
Yeah.
And she knew the pub, I think it's DeBarris, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Where Noel used to play all the time. And so when I left the next day, she said, you know, Noel plays at DeBarris, I think she might know him, give him a call when you get there, blah, 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 blah. So I ended up going, hitching a ride to Clonakilty, DeBarris, and I got there, and there was no, you know, Noel or Roy or anything like that. And so when I get there, I call up Noel Redding, basically to Jimi Hendrix. This is where it gets funny.
Yeah.
So I call up Noel at the lady answers, and I said, "Hi, is Noel there?" And she's like, "Yeah, I asked who's calling." I said, "Oh, it's Bill." And I hear her yelling, "No, it's Bill." And so he comes on, and I said, "Hi, you know, this is Bill. I'm a friend of Roy's, and I can't remember where he lives." And, you know, and she said, "Oh, you know, he's way back over on the east side of Cork, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, you got to go back over this way, blah, 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 blah." And so he gives me directions on how to get there.
That's surreal, isn't it?
And I thanked him very much, but basically, you know, I basically bluffed my way through Noel Redding's screening device, and may he rest in peace, because since then he's passed on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And got directions to Roy's place.
Yeah.
So then I went, you know, east of Cork to this little village, and when I got there, I just asked somebody, you know, where does Roy live? And he said, "Oh, up on the, you know, hill in the mansion type thing." Walked up to his door. This is so bizarre. Walk up to his door, knock on the door. Who opens the door? Roy.
Yeah.
And he just looked at me, and it was so bizarre because it was just like, you know, this crazed American looking kid to be. And I had long hair there, and I'm 6 foot. Kind of looked like a bit like Charles Manson. You know, and Roy's not the tallest guy.
No,
cool,
he's
and everything.
Quite
he's
slight,
like,
yeah.
You know, who are you type thing? And I'm like, "Well, you don't know me, but, you know," I said, "Sunshine from Copenhagen," which is like the key password. And he's like, "Well, come on in," you know, very nice and everything. And he lets me in, and I had to pretty much confess right away that I didn't really know Sunshine from Copenhagen, and I told the whole story like I've just told you. And he pretty much, you know, realized pretty quickly that I was just some crazy fan. But he could tell, I think, personality-wise, that I wasn't, you know, there to harm him.
You weren't a nutter.
Crazy in that respect.
Yeah.
Crazy to be stupid enough to hitchhike to his place on a pilgrimage, you know, like it was like some John Lennon type person, you know.
Well, yeah.
And he was very, very nice and very, very hospitable. It turned out that, you know, this was the period about 6 months or so from when the whole thing went down with Jackie.
Yeah.
He was in a very dark space. He had been living there alone for a long time. And he was very nice. He said, "Look, I just finished Death of Glory. I need to work on it tonight. Go back to the DeBarris and, you know, go listen to Noel's band, play for the night, and then come back later on." And I came back at like midnight, and then he played me the first half of it
right
through which is, you know, Miles Remains, and I think one track after that. And
yeah.
I was just absolutely floored. I actually sat there and took notes on each song as he played it for me, and I was just floored. I mean, it was just amazingly personal music. And I think he was even, you know, had like a tear running down his cheek during some of the songs and stuff. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah.
I didn't hear the second half of the time, but it was just, you know, amazingly personal music. He let me sleep on the couch for the night. You know, very, very nice guy. I was amazed. Next morning, he made me tea and toast, and he said he had to, you know, fly from Cork over to Abbey Road Studios to go mix the album.
Mm.
So he drove me, you know, that day. Oh, I remember when I woke up in the morning, there was nobody there. It was like I'm walking around this place, and there's nobody, and I'm like, it's beautiful and it's quiet, but like, where is he?
Yeah.
It's kind of strange. And the next thing I know, I hear this huffing like some kind of giant, you know, coming around the corner. I was like, what the hell is going on? It's very strange. And it was Roy coming back from a jog, and he was very winded.
Right.
But he had this really strange huffy sound going on, and that's when he made me the toast and tea. But, you know, he rode me back to Cork, where I caught the bus back to Dublin, and then he flew off to London. I got to tell you, there's a line in, I just was listening the other day to the live version of, I think it's Highway Blues on Flashes, where he says, has anyone ever rode casually in my
car? That's it. That's
remember
the one, yes.
Well, having rode from his place to Cork, I consider Mr. Bill on Mr. Bill's Wild Ride a pretty crazy driver. Having rode in his car to Cork,
yeah,
I would never, ever get in a car with him.
I had the pleasure of having a couple of rides in his car over the summer.
He's not the casual traveler.
And I kept thinking of that song as well and laughing.
Yeah. And just the last thing I have to say about going to meet him and all that was it was such a good experience, because it really, you know, I think I had this mythology of who the man was before I met him.
Yeah.
And this was a good reality check, because it took the man off the pedestal and made him a real man.
Very much so.
As to, you know, it knocked him off the pedestal, and I realized that this is a human being. Obviously, he was in a very frail state from the breakup of his marriage, but it was really, you know, humanitizing of him. I realized that he was a human and that he had needs and wants, and you know, that, you know, it gave me a much more holistic and humble and realistic view of the person and his life, and not so much an idealistic and, you know, hero worship and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Made me appreciate him as a person and as a poet and as a fellow human being traveling on the planet, who's just gifting us with his, you know, presence and his music, as opposed to, you know, oh my God, he's a, you know, this great person, and, you know, bow down, we're not worthy.
Yeah.
I mean, it really made me appreciate him as a person and as a really nice guy who just, you know, took a totally stranger in from across the planet and put him up for the night.
He's very gracious.
You know, he had his busking times, and he did that before, and he did that for someone else. And I thought that was just very nice of him. So that's my Pilgrimage to Roy story.
Very nicely put. Stepping away from Roy. Okay, and that's part one of the interview. Part two will be next month. Hope you're enjoying it so far. I had a really nice time talking to Bill, even though I was ill. Actually, we went to a place called the Asma Caves in Turkey, which is a place underground that claims to have 95% humidity, very warm, and there's like stalactites all over the place, and it claims to be able to deal with chest conditions and cure asthma and all kinds of stuff. I spent quite a long time down there, and all sorts of horrible things happened to my nose when we came outside, so maybe it worked, who knows? I thought you'd like to know that. Okay, A to Z of Harper next. This is O. Now, the big temptation, of course, was to pick One of Those Days in England, which I played the single version of, but I actually picked Once, and I'm talking here about both the track and the album. Once came out on the Awareness record label, and as far as I can recall, it was the first proper studio album that Awareness did off their own back, so to speak, and it was very well received as a return to form for Roy, and contains a whole bunch of different songs. Once is a rather nice song about the fact you only get one go at stuff in life. In his lyric book, Roy says, Once is a song structured in a similar way to the Lord's Prayer, in that the verse lines are all short four-word abstract concepts making up a poem of approx 16 words. The verses are written using the same preposition, for, so that as a whole it's quite a tight piece of grammar. I realised as I was writing it that this was going to help the overall uniform theme Once, an ongoing conviction and a song I look back on with affection.
Now for the dance.
Time for a bit of feedback now, and we're talking about episode 15, which had the interview with Dave Cochran. I had an email from Colin. He said, "Hi Paul, best episode so far in my humble opinion. Really enjoyed it as a whole. Music selection, the relaxed, informative interview with Dave, and on his feedback from Windjammer, read the Roy Harper interviews, your comment on his feedback. Hope you don't mind, but on Bill Bruford's forum, I've submitted a link to this episode for folks to listen to it for the Dave Cochran interview, remembering working with Bill, who has an autobiography out next March. Will working with Roy be mentioned in it? Cheers, Colin. P.S. Have BBC Tapes Volume 4 already. Think I shall now be purchasing Volume 5 as well. Cheers, Colin. Yeah, I was really pleased with the interview with Dave, and it was a nice kind of antidote after quite a serious and long interview with Roy to have something a bit more light-hearted and fun. And the fact we we did the interview at a pub and Dave was drinking white wine and I was drinking a nice pint of beer probably helped the relaxed atmosphere a bit. Glad you liked it anyway. And I'm really pleased that you put a thing on Bill Bruford's forum about the podcast. The more the merrier. So hi to anybody that's still listening as a result of following that. And I'm also pleased that you've picked up another BBC tapes CD. I mean, this isn't a commercial podcast, but obviously one of the things I want to do is play music for people to encourage them to pick up albums they may not already have. So, you know, good news all around. Thanks very much. In other general comments, Adam Leonard said, "I enjoyed that. Cheers, Paul. Dave seems like a great fella. Good musical selection too. That version of Grown Ups is ace, and I've forgotten how good Naked Flame was too. I'd not heard the original version for ages, even though it's one of my favourites, Let Your Dingle Dangle in the Dust." Actually, this whole thing about not hearing things for ages is very pertinent. I obviously listen to a lot of tracks while I'm making the podcast, and I don't listen to Roy's albums too much because I'm almost over-familiar with them, and this is a nice way for me to sort of listen to things again and remember how good they are. Nick Lane said, "What a great podcast, thoroughly enjoyable, relaxed and entertaining with a good real background going on, which made a refreshing change from the pod cave." Really excellent, Paul. Keep up the good work. What other surprises have you got up your sleeve? Well, you know, time will tell. And on the forums, LA Drain said, Paul, what a cracking interview with Dave Cochran. Pity Lynn's question was rather quiet. Yeah, it was. But anyway, she was quite away from the microphone and he's a bit timid in real life. Not what you'd expect from a PR person. I think she, she manages to become untimid when work dictates. And she herself says it was quiet because I'm a rather shy and quiet person and it wasn't my interview and didn't want to stick my oar in. Yes, and she also said, oh, you want to fire that photographer? It looks like a lamppost is extending from your shoulder. She's talking about the thing on the show notes. Well, she took the photo, that's why she's saying that. And Pete Cunliffe said, great stuff again, I enjoyed that. And Sean said, some great rock and roll stories. Also enjoyed the choice of music, especially Naked Flame in the game. Love to hear some more stories of Dave sometime. The interview sound was quite surreal too. I heard a few snippets of passers-by conversations, etc. It was quite trippy through my headphones. Cheers, Sean. Yeah, I've been talking to Dave a bit since we did that, and he's, you know, a friendly guy. We're definitely going to get together again when we get the chance and have another little session, so that's something to look forward to in the future, hopefully. We've only got time left for a little bit of feedback, so... Credits and copyright. This podcast is issued under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 2.0 UK, England and Wales license, which means you can share it with others, but you can't change it, claim you made it, or charge for it. The Roy Harper music in this podcast is used by kind permission of Science Fiction Limited and is not for copying or redistribution. The intro music was called Eregli Oyun Havasi, Turkish dance music, which I got from www.dunav.org. That's D-U-N-A-V, which is a good resource for that kind of music and all sorts of stuff about Turkish and other Middle Eastern dance. Leave feedback at podcast@stormcot.net. Send in voicemails, please, on 01223 850 282, or email me an MP3 file. That's it for this month. See you next time. Bye.